As originally speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Chris Nolte. It's time to check in with how the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance is doing as they are, as a group, getting ready to lobby with lawmakers, if they haven't already, to work toward a two-year state budget that includes more services for public transportation in Indiana. And with us, we have the president of the IPRA with us, Steve Coxhead. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Well, we know that you and your colleagues who are at the Alliance have been busy getting the troops out there, if they haven't already been out there, to talk with individual state lawmakers, state representatives, and state senators to get your views in as the work is underway to craft a new two-year state budget. First, tell us a little bit about what the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance would like for the lawmakers to do and how you're hoping that maybe they'll be able to accomplish that goal.
Okay, yes, happy to. Currently, state of Indiana supports the Hoosier Strait, the Amtrak Hoosier State service to a limited extent. There's state support for a train which is 3 days a week, one train in each direction each day, okay? What we really need to have happen in order for this service to be able to pay for itself, let's say, is to have more frequencies, as we would call it. We would need the train to actually run 7 days a week and basically have one train in each direction each day. So that would be a little bit more than doubling. Now that combined with Amtrak's long-distance Cardinal service, which starts out in New York City and comes to Indianapolis on the way up to Chicago, that would actually give the Hoosier State three trains a day, which would get to the point where you have enough ridership that you have fare box revenue of a magnitude that covers operating costs. Now, for this to happen, what Indiana would have to do would have to be to increase the line item in the Department of Transportation budget for the upcoming biennial. So it would support those extra frequencies, basically doubling what's in there now. The General Assembly has just started the budget-making process. The budget will be adopted in April. And, you know, train advocates and infrastructure advocates can do all sorts of good things. But what really matters is to get to your state representatives and also possibly pen a letter or something to the commissioner of NDOT, indicating how important it would be to the state, for whatever reasons particularly appeal to you, that the state support a doubling of this service. Now, you know, we say support. We don't like to say subsidy because basically it's an investment. Once the service gets going, you generate eventually enough fare box revenue so you pay for the operation. So what we're talking about really is startup costs. And this is the time to talk to your state representative. They actually do listen and make sure they know that it's important to include this specific line item in the budget for NDOT. So it's not just a vague, well, more money for trains.
Right.
We want to basically double the amount of the line item for Hoosier State support in the NDOT budget. So that's probably the most important thing. And of course, going beyond that, we have the proposed Chicago, Fort Wayne, Columbus, Ohio service. It has been chugging along. I think most of us agree that it's going to be very difficult to tell what kind of federal money might be available, if any, over the next year or 2 years. So we would encourage Indiana to do what it can to push this project along. And here again, that happens by people talking to their state representatives about how important it is for this service. And last but certainly not least, we want to include the expanded South Shore service up here in this region. I think most people up here realize that it's important to keep us competitive with the other Chicago collar counties. And Governor Holcomb has been very good about supporting that project. And, you know, we would hope that support continues into the next budget.
Speaking of the governor, and getting back to at least what might be possibly included in the budget to expand the existing service, we know that Governor Holcomb definitely likes to see more things that will in turn mean economic development or expansion and jobs as well. Do you think that maybe that might be a point, even though he hasn't officially set forth, at least not before the members of the legislature? He does that at his State of the State address coming up, but he's probably certainly made some mention to some people about whether he'd like to see some help that would go to the South, to the Hoosier State, to the Cardinal Lines, or at least whatever, certainly the Hoosier State, because the state does help out in that respect, to be able to get the service expanded.
Right. I mean, up here, the economic effect, I think, is very apparent and very direct. You know, we're in direct competition with several Illinois counties as places to live and hence as places to pay their state taxes. If you look further afield, the Hoosier State and the Cardinal Service, basically they go diagonally across the state, linking our biggest population centers. Modern passenger rail service is something that the people coming of age in the 21st century like. So there is an economic effect, too. Having good transportation services are an incentive for firms to move into Indiana, either from out of state or even out of the country. I think we saw bids for Amazon's second headquarters, and one of Amazon's criteria was they needed a location that had well-developed public transportation. Well, Indiana kind of lost out on that. We don't want to have that happen again. Also, the young people that are coming of age, the people that are going to be the workers in 21st century businesses and industries, they like transportation, okay? They like their cars. They also like to have public transportation as an option. So if Indiana has a well-developed modern rail passenger system in the state, that will serve as a lure of the kind of younger people that you want to have as workers in the industries of the 21st century. You can say that for the Hoosier State as well as the Fort Wayne, Columbus-Chicago route. It does have an economic payoff, you know, because it has to do with attracting the right kind of labor force.
Is there a self-imposed deadline that you and the other members of the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance have set or would like to set to be able to get your lobbying efforts done to lawmakers before they start locking things in for the upcoming budget?
Well, of course, the budget's going to be finalized in April. I would say the sooner the better. You definitely, I think, need to have that conversation with your state rep. I would say in January or February at the latest, because there are lead times. These things have to go through committees and they get discussed, you know, and so forth. So I would say the sooner the better. Certainly, you know, no later than February, during January if possible. We want to make sure that line item is in there. There is a draft budget circulating from NDOT, which actually has a zero budget for the Hoosier State. We don't think that's going to be the final word, but that's what's circulating now. On the other hand, we had been given to understand a few months ago from NDOT that there is political support in the General Assembly for at least the support that was given in the last budget.
Right, so, at least continue it on without any increases, but no cuts then.
Right, and so we're looking at a situation, I guess you could say, that's kind of up in the air. Mm-hmm. Right now, I wouldn't want to lay money on or place a bet on what's going to happen. We think there's support for at least support similar to the last budget. We'd like to think that there is support and truthfully money in the, you know, room in the budget for doubling those frequencies. But because of the uncertain state of the budget that's circulating now, we really need to talk to people about what's going to be in there.
One of the things I wanted to talk with you about, Steve, while we had a chance to talk today, is finding out if there's anything that we should pass along about the state of Amtrak. I know there's been some concern that you all had during 2018 about how Amtrak was doing, and we're talking about all the way up at the top echelon of Amtrak management. We still have problems, still have concerns that the Passenger Rail Alliance is watching?
Yes. And the Passenger Alliance definitely has a concern with what appears to be the current Amtrak business plan, in as much as it seems to be crafted after a business plan that's been applied in the airline industry, which basically has resulted in fewer flights and fewer airports being served. We have serious doubts as to whether that business plan is appropriate to a rail system. Primarily because Amtrak's mission, ultimately, if you go back to the beginning, is to provide an integrated passenger rail service nationally. Also, if you look at the idea that rail can provide service to points between the two endpoints. For instance, if you fly from Cincinnati to Chicago, you can't, you know, get out of the plane in between. If you take a modern train, you can get out of the plane in Crawfordsville, Indianapolis, Connersville. Also, part of this plan seems to be to decrease onboard services, which might work on an airplane where you're only on board for a short period of time, but which is really going to drive people away from trains where the travel times are, in some respects, longer.
Well, so, you take away those sleeper cars, you know, especially if you have a really long trek. If you make those services not available or less attractive, that's going to make it even worse to get those long-distance passengers on.
Well, and in fact, there's a good deal of thought, calm thought, that looks at the economics of the sleeper cars and says, you know, the sleeper cars are probably subsidizing the short-term coach service, okay? There's also some thought that the long-distance service, that is the sleeper service, is generating revenue, which in fact subsidizes Amtrak's operations on the Northeast Corridor, which they don't like to talk about. So. Yeah. Yeah, there are criticisms being leveled at Amtrak, both about the business plan, you know, and about the accounting. What is distressing is that there doesn't really seem to be a proactive, positive response from Amtrak as an organization when these items of criticism are raised. The organization seems to be doing what it does, regardless of what many well-informed and intelligent members of the traveling public have to say. And I guess you could say that is really our complaint. You know, no organization is perfect, but you would hope that an organization, especially one in the public sector, such as transportation, would listen and take into account the concerns of the community it's supposed to serve. We don't have a warm, fuzzy feeling that that's what Amtrak is trying to do right now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically the heart of our concern. And I will say that on a national level, the Rail Passenger Association, which operates nationally, has similar concerns and is trying to work with Amtrak to address them.
Well, it sounds like at least that there's some other organizations besides the Indiana delegation, so to speak, that's trying to encourage Amtrak to make improvements and like to, so you have some help, I guess, backing you up in that respect. A lot of other organizations apparently are wishing the same thing as well, too. So it looks like certainly for the short term, the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance is most concerned about making sure that the funding that is already in the NDOT budget going into the new budget cycle coming up is in there for the Hoosier State and the help for Cardinal Service as well, too. So it's just making sure that lawmakers are lobbied and they're reminded about the fact that the train service is important, and it'd be even better still if we could get some expansion to it.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, dropping back for a second to the national level, Indiana has two Republican senators now.
Mm-hmm.
Republican Party has a majority in the Senate. I think Senator Todd is on the Transportation Committee. Okay. Those would be good people to talk to about your concerns about rail transportation, because ultimately we need to have a healthy Amtrak system to make everything work.
Well, it certainly sounds like a good way to get 2019 started, to be sure. And we thank you very much, Steve, for being with us to talk about at least the concerns and the efforts to lobby state lawmakers to get the support in the short term, and that is over the next 2 years, to make sure that the passenger rail service is alive and continues on, to be sure. And we'll be back to check and see how things progress, I suppose, during the budget cycle coming up then.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Steve Coxhead is the president of the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. We're revisiting conversations from the past year for Green Fleet Radio, and today here's your host, Carl Lissick, from a conversation that was first aired on November 7th of 2018.
Well, thank you for the introduction, and welcome to Green Fleet Radio. Today, our guest is Mr. Gus Olympidis. He's the president and CEO of Family Express. Gus, welcome to the show.
It's good to be here.
Well, I think most of our listeners know Family Express, but for those who may not, tell us, what is Family Express and what do you do?
Basically, we're a local chain of convenience stores, born and raised in Northwest Indiana, that is built in the context of people that have a genetic predisposition to build relationships. So, which is nice.
Mm-hmm. It is nice. So we know Family Express was an early adopter of ethanol, and I know that you were involved with the Hoosier Homegrown Fuel Blender Pump Program to further your commitment. Tell us a bit about your decision to add ethanol to your fuel offerings, and why did you make that decision?
Yeah, Carl, this is going back a few years, yes. Maybe 13 or 14 mm-hmm. years. There was a time in my life where I looked at the state of our energy reality in our country, and I felt compelled to be a part of the solution. These were the early stages of investing in biofuels in Indiana for the simple reason that we can produce biofuels in Indiana, and we have the blessing of corn and water, and we are geographically apropos for developing energy that is renewable. But most importantly, during those years, most of us have forgotten that our country was investing close to between $500 and $750 billion a year to buy energy abroad. It's been said that this was the vastest migration of wealth in the history of mankind. It was clearly unsustainable. And since then, our nation has sort of gotten its act together. And today, I don't believe it's an accident that we're celebrating a robust economy. At the same time, we're celebrating the ability of our nation not just to meet its needs, but also to export energy.
So we understand ethanol makes a good environmental sense, but it also makes good economic sense. Can you share a bit of information about the cost savings associated with ethanol and how it helps Indiana farmers?
Well, any kind of domestic energy has the economic multiplier of local. Anytime you export capital for energy, you lose the multiplier at the very least. So we're talking about domestic jobs. We're talking about a cleaner environment. But equally as importantly, you and I have had the conversation about the hidden cost of traditional energy being replaced by ethanol because of the inherent $1.50 to $2.50 per gallon cost for defense to facilitate its existence. So not only ethanol makes economic sense when you look at it just by itself, but when you think of it in the context of energy independence and the minimizing of the necessity for us to support armies, navies, and air forces all over planet Earth to keep sea lanes open, it's hard to argue about the wisdom of biofuels. It's just, I think, if for no other reason, take economics out of it, and the economics, the economic argument is very compelling. As patriots, we should be excited about buying energy from people that don't want to behead us.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I know ethanol isn't the only sustainability effort that Family Express is making. You've chosen to embrace energy efficiency in all of your convenience stores and stations as well. So tell our listeners a little bit about that.
Yeah, there's a little difference in our investment in energy efficiency through a variety of means, lighting, energy efficient furnaces, energy management systems, and what have you, versus the early contribution to the solution through biofuels. Today, diverting inefficient methods of delivering services that require energy to efficient makes economic sense to a great extent. That is a simple mathematical equation. I think good organizations that have a forward-thinking mindset and are planning to be around for a while make an investment in efficient devices because it makes economic sense. The early investment in E85 and ethanol was a decision of conscience. Mm-hmm. In fact, those early days, it was difficult to organize an economic argument for it. It just it's something that needed to be done because unless you provided the retail infrastructure for it, E85 would never get off the ground. Right. And it was a chicken and egg thing. And at some point, somebody had to just step up to the plate and do the right thing and hold your breath and not turn white for a few years. And today, it has evolve into also a good, a sound economic decision. But early on, it was the motivation was patriotism more than economic prudence.
Sure. Well, and you've continued that on for so many years, and you're the leader in our state and one of our leaders in this entire country with your commitment. So
first and foremost, you may be driving a flex fuel vehicle and not even know it.
Mm-hmm.
Flex fuel is more economic. You're going to hear some chatter about your gasoline mileage declining. It will decline modestly, but it's so much less expensive than regular fuel that at the end of the day, it makes economic sense and it helps the environment. Unlike some of the again the chatter. Using fuel that has been produced by consuming corn is not going to affect food supply.
Sure.
Don't expect to see any people starving because mm-hmm. you bought ethanol. Only a modest part of the corn that is produced, somewhere around 20%, goes to ethanol. And 80% of the corn that is used is returned back to in various forms, from animal feed to you name it. Consequently, the extraction of the fuel makes terrific sense for the environment, for our pocketbook and our economy. So you may be driving a vehicle that could use E85. If you're not driving a vehicle that is flex fuel, when you go to the pump, always choose unleaded 88 because it has a slightly higher content of ethanol. Instead of 10%, it's 15% ethanol. So again, that 5% doesn't sound like much, but with a multiplier of billions and billions of gallons, kind of think of it every time you use it in a subliminal way, in your mind and in your heart, you're waving an American flag.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, Gus, we're out of time, and that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Gus Olympidis, President and CEO of Family Express. Continued success to you. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. Remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities, and you can hear Green Fleet Radio on Wednesdays here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. And podcasts of Green Fleet Radio are also available on our website right now at lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Just search for WLPR. Some changes being made to the location of containers around recycling containers, we should say, around Porter County. The drop-off sites aren't changing, but the containers in those drop-off sites are. And to find out the reasons why the changes are being made, we are turning now to Donna Secker. She's the Public Education Coordinator for the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District. And as always, Donna, thanks for joining us here on the program.
Sure, anytime, Chris.
Well, we know that that recycling is very popular in Porter County. A lot of people use the drop-off locations. I think in many cases, and you mentioned in our past conversations, that there are folks that don't have curbside recycling available to them. Maybe they live in apartments or they're in condos, so they don't happen to have the boxes available at their homes. And so they're taking advantage of the drop-off sites. But unfortunately, you say there's been a lot of cases of some bad behavior by those who do use the drop-off sites. Tell us about what this bad behavior really is and give us a very real and a very disturbing example that you all have noted just today.
Well, we are dealing with too much contamination in our drop-off recycling. And contamination is simply anything, any object that doesn't belong in the containers is considered contamination. So in our containers, we find things like wood and mattresses and toilets and yard waste, and all of those kinds of things get placed in those containers, and they contaminate the materials that are actually appropriate to place in there. So I would say our drop-off recycling sites are running close to a 50% contamination rate.
Oh.
And now, because of what's going on in the world with recycling, there's a movement there's a push to reduce contamination so that the materials can be sold and are appropriate. And so we have to work at getting our boxes down to a 10% contamination. And anything above 10%, if a box is found to have more than 10% contamination, the entire box, including contents that are appropriate, is going to be landfilled.
Now, you mentioned that this is a decision to reduce the percentage of contamination. This is not just a decision that members of the Waste Reduction and Recycling District Board came up with, not some figure they pulled out of the air. There's a very real reason why you have to bring the contamination rates down.
Absolutely. And that happened a year ago when China and a number of countries that were huge consumers of our recyclables had said, we no longer want your garbage, that our recyclables, our materials were so contaminated with garbage that they would no longer purchase them from us. So that market essentially went away. So now a lot of us, a lot of places in the United States are left with recyclables that they can't sell, unfortunately. So now we are left with reducing the contamination rate so that we can sell these recyclables. And so what has happened is the sorting facilities were able to sell them for a while up until last year. Now they cannot. So they're telling the waste haulers, we don't want your contamination. And now the waste haulers are telling municipalities and residents, we will no longer take your contamination. So this international crisis has finally hit Northwest Indiana, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Now, give us the details that you can give us of the example that it's come down even as early as today in Porter County. What was the situation? And if we know how it's going to be resolved, tell us.
Well, today, Republic is our waste hauler, and they take the contents of these drop-off sites to their transfer stations and then and take those to the sorting facilities in Illinois. Well, in doing so, in taking one of our roll-off carts or boxes to the transfer station, they identified three bags labeled bio-waste. And at that point, they shut the box. They return it back to the site, and that's the site in Valparaiso on US 30. And Stericycle has been called to appropriately and safely remove those bags because obviously we don't know what's inside.
We should mention that we will have a photograph of that contaminated roll-off box with our program today on our pods in the podcast on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. You'll get to see for yourself what the inside of that roll-off box that was picked up by the Republic Services crew showed. You'll see those red bags sticking out. They're very obvious. You can't miss those. And you also mentioned, too, that I also noticed, too, that there's also some things that shouldn't go in there, too. Like there was a milk jug that still had milk in it.
Exactly.
And ironically,
this is all contamination.
And ironically, yeah. it was propped up next to one of those red bio-waste bags. I'm sure it just happened to be that way, but it's still there. Mm-hmm. And it's still, again, a good example of the fact that the contamination rates have to be reduced. There's no choice but to reduce the contamination. What are the changes that the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District has made at the drop-off sites to help keep the contamination down, bring the contamination down, and to keep it down?
Well, what we're going to do, and it obviously hasn't been done quite yet, is we're introducing brand new boxes. These are going to be locked so that people cannot open the lids, and they will have restricted openings. So somebody can't throw in a couch or a mattress. They will only be the size of the materials that we are accepting. So those will be two changes that people will see. So, for instance, if you've noticed in those pictures, people don't break down their boxes. Well, now they will have to break down their boxes or else they are not going to fit in those new containers.
Yeah, that's right, because if you have containers that only have restricted lids, slots, or whatever it may be, where you can't lift the lid up more than just what's there to be able to put mm-hmm. material in, you're going to have to make sure it fits, and that's the only way to do it. Yeah.
Exactly. And you probably noticed that people put bags of materials in there. Well, plastic bags are not recyclable. At least curbside. They're recyclable if you take them to certain stores. So those new restricted openings aren't going to be big enough for people to place an entire trash bag full of recyclables in there. So they're going to have to take the contents out. Those bags are going to be too big to place through the openings.
One of the things that, and we've talked about this in the past when we've talked about the recycling process, is that there is an opportunity here to not only be good to Mother Earth, which is the original concept, I suppose. It's also, and as you've mentioned here too, there's an economic value as well to being able to recycle. It's being able to economically reuse what's been used before into other products. It's out there. That's what the end users of what's collected and processed at places in Illinois that you mentioned, or even for that matter too. We'll even bring it even closer to home. We'll talk about the fact that we have recycling plants in Northwest Indiana that take in material, although they're getting it from the sorting process in Illinois. They're getting it back into Indiana, but the idea is they're still getting the material come in to reuse it for some other purpose. But the idea is that it has to be clean, and it's a point, I guess, where we have to, I guess, go back to thinking about what we're doing when it comes to recycling, that we just can't mindlessly recycle everything anymore.
That's correct. We have to think of our materials that we place in our curbside totes or in our drop-off boxes as a product that somebody wants to buy. So, and like China has said, we don't want your products with a bunch of garbage in it. And I was thinking the other day, if you're buying a car from somebody and somebody says, hey, maybe you want these toys, I'm going to throw these toys in the car, and maybe you can use an additional mattress. So now you're going to get the car and all of the stuff inside. Would you really want that product? So essentially, you know, they have to be clean. They have to be appropriate because you don't want some, the consumer wouldn't want something that you know, or purchase something that's not appropriate. So we have to think of it as a product and that somebody wants to buy and that we're going to sell.
We should mention, too, that Porter County Recycling drop-off sites are located in Burns Harbor, in Chesterton, in Valparaiso, in Hebron, and Boone Grove, and in Couts. And the opportunity to be able to bring recyclables to these points probably has been very, very popular and has resulted in a lot of material being recycled in Porter County over the years, hasn't it?
Oh, yes, absolutely. These boxes are extremely popular, and even though we have asked waste haulers to please make sure that they offer curbside recycling to everybody, that hasn't reduced the number of people, you know, using our drop-off boxes, for instance. And we also have to think that recycling is a big, has a big economic impact for not just here in Northwest Indiana, but for all of Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, a 2017 study by ISRI, which is the Institute of Scrap Recycling Industries, shows that 17,000 jobs here in Indiana directly supported recycling and the scrap brokerage operations. So, and the total wages paid for these jobs are $972 million, and taxes paid were $425 million. So recycling is very important, not just for saving energy and reducing pollution and greenhouse gases and conserving our natural resources, but we're also supporting an industry and fellow Hoosiers.
Well, something to think about, and when the changes are being made at the drop-off recycling sites in Porter County, what the hope is that the residents will continue to bring all of their recyclables that they can accept at those drop-off sites there and deal with the changes and help keep the recyclable amount up as high as possible, only a lot cleaner than apparently it has been happening in the past, the way that the old system was. So, and also, too, Don, I wanted to take a few moments here and talk about one other point that you mentioned, as besides the issues with the drop-off recycling sites in Porter County, you're also trying to encourage those people who set up special events to take advantage of the recycling process as well. Tell us about this the special program that you're creating to encourage this special event recycling.
Oh, absolutely. Well, special event coordinators in Porter County have a free service that we offer, and that is we loan out special event recycling containers that they can use and place next to their trash containers. And these containers accept beverage containers like water bottles and pop cans and even alcoholic beverage glass bottles and such, so that event coordinators can recycle a lot of those materials because, let's face it, special events create a lot of waste. And instead of collecting all of that and sending it to a landfill, we provide these special containers for free, and they can at least collect the beverage containers and be able to recycle those in the process.
Well, if there are people out there that really want to do their part, if they feel they can, then they can encourage whoever's participating in whatever event that they're in to do it. It's a great opportunity to promote the recycling process in Porter County anyway.
Absolutely, and no event is too small. I mean, you can use them for block parties, you can use them for street festivals, you can use them for banquets and graduation parties. I mean, coming May, June, some graduation parties are huge and they have hundreds of people. Well, all you have to do is call us and reserve these containers, and then you can have these at your graduation parties to collect all of the beverage containers and help reduce waste in the process. So it doesn't matter if you have a small party or you're having a festival, just give us a call and we'll lend you our containers.
Okay, Donna, we have just enough time to talk about what the website address is and the phone number. So if people are interested about the special event recycling, or for that matter, they have questions about the changes that are being made to the recycling drop-off sites around the county, where do they do that?
Sure. Come visit us at PorterCountyRecycling.org. Or give us a call at 465-3694, and we are always happy to help you with your recycling questions.
Well, Donna, thanks for your help today, and we hope we get the word out here about the changes that are coming in the Porter County drop-off recycling sites around the county and these special programs that are up there, too, to take advantage of. And if there are updates, I'm sure we'll be back with you to talk about them, too.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
You're welcome. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Ball State University Center for Business and Economic Research has released its 2019 Economic Outlook for the state and the regions, including Northwest Indiana. And the executive director of the center, Michael Hicks, was with us here on Regionally Speaking to talk about the report, beginning with the big picture.
We're right at the cusp of breaking the all-time business cycle recovery period dating back to 1840. So we're in a lengthy period of growth. It has not been fast growth. The growth for Indiana has been around 2%. From 2009 to 2017, 2018, we don't have the GDP numbers yet, but nationally, that is for the state, but nationally it was a good year. We had growth that'll probably end up in the 3 to 3.2% range, which is more like what we saw from the end of World War II to the start of the Great Recession than the end of the Great Recession to today. So it's been a pretty good year in 2018, and you know, labor markets are tight. Everybody who wants a job can find one. Consumer prices, up until the last few months, have been fairly stable. They're now growing at about 2.6% rate this year, the producer price index. And then wages have been rising for the first time in several years. We see wage increases for the median worker that are a good full percentage point above consumer prices for the year. So a pretty good 2018.
Now, based on the information that you all have gathered here from what you've been able to get out of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act information out of Washington, how does the picture look with all that together as far as the overall statewide picture look?
Right. So there's sort of three slices, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the tariff, and then the increase in interest rates that the Federal Reserve is following. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act sort of had two parts. The first part was to be really a tax cut on households that released an awful lot of consumer spending. So we saw that contributing significantly growth in the early part of 2018 and probably into the holiday season. The second part was to induce capital investment by existing firms. And there has been actually a slowdown in capital investment. And I think economists were wrong because we have not seen tax cuts like this come at a lengthy period of time of very low interest rates. So maybe businesses were less sensitive to a big tax cut. And then the third effect was supposed to be the repatriation of somewhere between $2 and $2.5 trillion held by corporations externally. And that did not occur. We saw only about 10% of that come back over 2018. So we saw a consumption-based growth in the economy in 2018, not an investment-based growth. And those things are important. Investment-based growth tends to have longer-term effects. The consumption-based growth tends to be pretty transient. So we think we've had a good year in terms of consumption, but not a lot of business investment moving forward into later years. Northwest Indiana has one benefit that some of the other parts of the state doesn't, that's a higher degree of urbanization. So you have some troubled places. Obviously, Gary, Michigan City, you know, South Bend is still struggling economically, but there are also an equal number of places that are doing quite well. Population and larger concentration of households, frankly, are places where most of the economic growth is concentrated. And so Northwest Indiana, Northern Indiana, the central part of the state outside of Louisville are doing quite well. Mm-hmm. The other regions are really holding their own. You know, Fort Wayne looks to be improving, but Terre Haute, Muncie, really struggling. Central Indiana and its reach as far north as Kokomo, you know, are far south, maybe as Columbus, are sort of the bright spots in the state right now.
I was wondering if it turns out that we're still seeing this impact where maybe not, it doesn't necessarily mean that Marion County, Indianapolis per se, but the collar counties, all those counties that are around Indianapolis and Marion County are the ones that are continuing to show the biggest growth areas as well as the biggest potential for growth.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, let's just break it down. Since the turn of the century, we're now 18 years into, almost 19 years into a new century, we've had a dozen Indiana counties that are solidly growing at or above the national level of growth. Those are the Donut counties, Allen County and Fort Wayne, Porter and Lake counties, one county outside of Louisville, and that's it. There are 60 counties that are in absolute decline. Their population is shrinking. Their economy is relatively stagnant or in decline. And then the remainder, right, another 20 or so, are in between. They're growing, but they're growing more slowly than the nation as a whole. So they're in relative decline. So most of the state geographically is in decline. Well over a third of the population lives in places that are doing quite well and are growing and pulling people from around the country. Maybe not at the rates we would like to see, but certainly places that where growth is occurring and should be expected into the distant future. No Indiana rural county has really grown population absent a casino or just one or two counties because of a casino or a large car factory over the last 60 or 70 years. And so it shouldn't be a surprise. There's still some people, some policymakers who are embracing the policies of the 1950s and 60s. And there's some people who maybe think that something more recently, you know, China trade or NAFTA played a part in it. But, you know, long before China had any manufacturing or there was any significant manufacturing in Mexico, rural places in the Midwest and smaller towns like Muncie and Terre Haute have been facing a very deepening crisis. And it's true in Gary and Michigan City as well. Absent a very rural place like Switzerland County that, you know, has 26,000 people in it, what casinos mostly do is they just reallocate jobs from one sector to the other. So they pay a little bit better. So if you don't have a high school diploma or you just have a high school diploma, you can maybe make another dollar or two an hour working at a casino. But it's not an economic panacea that is so often portrayed to be the case.
That's Ball State University economist Michael Hicks in our conversation that was aired first right before the holidays. Time now for Lakeshore Public Radio's furry friend Ollie to join us in the studio to answer your pet's questions on Ask Ollie. It's supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana. The pet questions are voiced by man-human Tom Maloney and Ollie's responses by woman-human Victoria Voller.
Dear Ollie, I need your advice. I'm a very handsome brown and beige full-bred Chihuahua dog, and I'm worried I'll be caught by our local animal control and deported directly to Chihuahua, Mexico. Wherever that is in the universe, I can't swim the Rio Grande or jump any wall that Mexico might pay to have built. But I could dig under it to escape my fate. Even though I think I was born here and have my very own microchip, I'm concerned because I was rescued from the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana in Miller, and I find myself a little dog with no papers. Dog haters will see that I look like all the other 5-pound chihuahuas from the dog shelters and see no difference even with my chip. I don't bark with an accent, and I don't have a record with animal control. I don't even understand the Spanish language. But I'm afraid. I wish I were a hunting dog. I bet all the golden retrievers and boxers aren't worried about deportation. Maybe if I had been enrolled in dog training classes at Canine Connect in Valparaiso, I would have some papers at least. I'm not even a service dog with a cute red vest. I'm just a bed warmer, not a very big one at that. My pet mom carries me around in a big handbag or cat carrier tote, whatever. I'm thinking I can hide there, or in a pillowcase, or even a bottom drawer. Maybe no one can find me there. Buster Brown, East Chicago, Indiana.
Dear Buster, you seem to be growling a lot in misery, and I get it. It's a challenge not knowing your status as either a Native American-born dog or one brought here as a pup, or what's even harder, what Americans are currently thinking about this. Immigration discrimination is cyclical. At the turn of the century, the Irish, St. Patrick's Day festivities and shamrocks weren't welcome in America, and that included the Irish setter dog as well. Then we had World War II, and everything German fell out of popularity, including the shepherd dogs. After the Pearl Harbor attack, the poor little Japanese chin dog and every product made in Japan was out. I remember hearing that in 2003, some Americans were so angry with French politics, they wanted to rename our delicious French fries into Freedom Fries. So I understand the roots of your paranoia. But there's always hope that this whole Mexican wall thing will pass too. In fact, the American Kennel Club just released their list of most popular dog breeds for 2017. And guess what? The German Shepherd and the French Bulldog are in the top five. Go figure. In my heart of hearts, I believe you are many tweets away from grabbing the attention of the White House. After all, you are a Chihuahua, just like the saucy little hot tamale associated with a certain fast food Mexican restaurant. That little fellow is renowned for being the world's tiniest dog with the world's biggest personality. And you said you don't have a record. You're law-abiding. You've made a great contribution to the American economy and culture. And I read somewhere that you really don't like strangers too much and you make a good watchdog. Boy, that's hard to believe. So don't quit your day job at the fast food restaurant to become a watchdog. I can tell by your writing you're a fast learner and very intelligent, which is why I said stick with the fast food gig. There's money there. While at the same time, stay close to your pet mom by hiding in that roomy tote bag. This too will pass. Sure, you may be accused of scheming with this plan, but remember, the conversation about deportation has been by two-legged folk about two-legged folk. Buster, you're a schemer with four legs and not a dreamer with only two. I think you're safe. When talking immigration policies, let's hope that four-legged schemers are never on anybody's radar. Your friend, Infer, Ollie.
If you have a question for your friend Infer Ollie, you can email it to ollie@lakeshorepublicmedia.org. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana, and you get to hear Ollie every Wednesday here on Regionally Speaking. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. Tomorrow, Thursday, it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and then we will have from the Times State House reporter Dan Carden with us, along with business reporter Joseph Pete. From the Post Tribune, we'll have Greg Tejeda, who covers news and events in the City Hall at Gary. And we'll also have Indiana Public Broadcasting Station's reporter Becca Costello with a special feature. It's all coming up tomorrow.